America at a Crossroads is a weekly live webinar series that brings together journalists, scholars, thought leaders, and policymakers for discussions regarding the state of American democracy, where we've been, where we are, and where we're going. The series was jointly founded by Jews United for Democracy and Justice and Community Advocates, Inc. To register for our live webinars, join our email list at JewsUnitedForDemocracy.org.
And now please welcome Warren Olney, the award-winning legendary broadcast journalist whom we appreciate deeply. Warren was the host and executive producer of the nationally syndicated Public Radio International weekday afternoon program To the Point, and for many years, the legendary public affairs program Which Way LA. He has been honored repeatedly for his excellence over his very lengthy career. And we all, at least in Southern California, know him like he's a member of our family. So, Warren, thank you so much, and it's all yours.
Thank you, Janice. You're very kind, and it's always a great privilege and pleasure to me to be on America at a Crossroads. Thanks for that kind introduction. It's nice to hear, although I'm not sure I want to be a legend. I think that sounds like I've gone on too long. With all that's going on in the world, I think today, the question that you're asking is the right one to bring in the new year. Is there a path to peace in a world at war? Certainly we are a world at war, particularly in Ukraine and Gaza. I think we have the right man at the right time to explore the prospects for 2024. Admiral Mike Mullen served 43 years in the Navy on land and at sea. He was the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff for 12 years during the George W. Bush administration and the first 4 years of Barack Obama. Before that, he was chief of naval operations and leader of NATO's Joint Force Command as well, very important military assignments. Since his retirement, he served on a number of corporate boards. He also led a delegation to Taiwan for President Biden in 2022, obviously keeping his hand in when it comes to public affairs. Admiral Mullen, great to talk with you once again, and thanks a lot for being with us.
Good to be with you, Warren, and obviously there's a lot to talk about.
There is a lot to talk about. And I'm wondering, when we talk about peace, if we should define our terms, and given what's going on in the world, and there's so many things, as I say, that we need to talk about in detail, is it really, before we talk about peace, time to talk about preventing confrontations from escalating beyond where they are already?
Well, when Hamas went in on October 7th, there were a couple things I thought initially. One is I thought it was a suicide mission on the part of Hamas. I know Israel pretty well, and I think the Israelis, I thought the Israelis would react not unlike they have in terms of a very significant strategic and tactical commitment to eliminate and eradicate Hamas. Secondly, I worried a great deal about whether it would expand. Would Hezbollah and Lebanon get involved? Would Syria get involved? And would Iran be more active? And really, until the last couple of days, I think that has been pretty well contained. But what we saw with the killing of the Hamas leader in Lebanon yesterday, and then the massive bombing in Iran today, which I don't think Israel had anything to do with. I think it's really timed for the situation. That expansion, you know, that it is now, people have asked me, will it expand? It's expanding. The question is, can it be contained? And that's an unknown. The other thing I thought, you know, back in October at some point in time, not too long after they went in, is we're going to have to do something about Iran. We've been at this with Iran on and off for some 40 plus years, and it hasn't worked very well. They are conventionally, I'm not overly concerned about their military, but from a proxy standpoint, they're masters of the universe, and that, which has been an issue for some time. And I think that's going to have to be addressed in the longer term. Whether that, certainly I'd like to see that not be part of the current war with respect to Israel and Hamas, because I think that would be really dangerous. Obviously we have war in Europe right now. We're in a very, very delicate situation in the Western Pacific, you know, with Taiwan, who has an election here in a couple of weeks. So it's a very, very fragile environment. And I would hope, and we can get into this a little more about how do you get to peace, But I would hope that global leaders recognize the seriousness of the overall situation, and that we can get diplomacy in particular and engagement, you know, ahead of this. And we don't appear to be able to do that right now.
As always, you've said a lot of things that lead to follow-up questions. I have never heard anybody before say that Iran is the master of the universe. Tell us more about what you mean by that. And obviously, we have the Houthis, we have Hezbollah, we have Hamas as well. Is that what you mean? Is it those subsidiary characters? Yeah,
if I didn't say it, I meant to say, while I'm not hugely concerned about their conventional military, they are the masters of the universe in the proxy world. So those outfits that you just...
You did say that. Yeah,
mentioned, yeah. And they really are. And we're going to have to figure out a way to match up and address that so that they are put in a position where they just can't keep doing what they're doing. I think, you know, a lot smarter people than I have opined on why this started. I actually believe it started because Hamas and Iran were getting marginalized. Saudi Arabia and other Arab countries were getting closer to doing a deal with Israel with respect to Middle East peace. And I think that was a real threat to both Hamas and Iran. That's obviously put aside right now. I would hope that leaders would continue to focus on that as soon as they can, because I think that two-state solution is the answer. And it is very threatening and allows us to, quite frankly, isolate Iran very possibly in a way they haven't been before.
Well, let's talk about these proxies. Most recently, the Houthis have come to attention. They hadn't been spoken about much before. I don't think a lot of people know who they are, a tribe that's engaged in civil war against Saudi Arabia at the tip of the, in Yemen, at the tip of the Arabian Peninsula, now attacking ships. And apparently driving up the cost of international transportation as a result. They've been hit by American forces already. Should we attack them more?
Well, I think we have to. I think we certainly have to take that into consideration. I think it was a year ago or maybe 2 years ago when the ship in the Red Sea basically turned across the Red Sea. So that ship jammed up the Red Sea. And the compounding effect on commerce around the world was almost instantaneous and exponential. And so this is a vital seaway. There's no question, not just for us or our interests, but for the world and the world economy. And so they're going to have to be dealt with. I think they can be dealt with. Yemen's a particularly tough spot. We know too much about it, quite frankly, because of the proxy wars that have been going on there and the Iranians who very specifically support the Houthis and that against Saudi Arabia. And they've been in a very difficult war there over the last several years, some semblance of peace, if you will, in the last year or so. But I think they're going to have to be dealt with, as are the other proxies over time, if they continue to try to accelerate and expand this war.
Who are the Houthis? Are there ways of dealing with them short of military action?
I'm not sure. Most of my experience with them has been on the military side. They live mostly in the north of the country. They've been very difficult to dig out. They control a significant part of Yemen. So in that regard, it's almost like the way you've got to deal with them, quite frankly, is through Tehran and the leadership there, because they do listen to those leaders.
They listen, but they also do what they're told.
That's correct. I mean, I think Iran can control that. I think Iran is controlling what's going on right now with respect to the Houthis.
Let's talk about Hamas and this strike in Beirut that killed Saleh Arouri. He was the most senior Hamas figure killed so far since October 7th. I think others were killed as well. Everybody believes that Israel did that. To what extent is that liable to spread the war beyond the borders? Or is it already?
Well, I think it's hard to know exactly. Nasrallah, who is the leader of Hezbollah, spoke, I think, yesterday, and there was some expectation that he would be more aggressive in his speech than he actually was. He's been pretty careful, as has Iran, since October 7th, to basically send a message to Hamas to say, by and large, you're on your own here, and they don't want to get pulled into that. Now, could that change as a result of this? One of the things I learned, you know, in the Middle East, for sure, I first heard it in the Middle East years ago, was usually there'll be a response, and it is a time and place of our choosing. And so while it may not be instantaneously, I can't believe that Hezbollah isn't going to figure out a way to generate some kind of response. And then I think it's it becomes the quality of that response. I heard someone talking earlier, if it's downtown Tel Aviv, that's really problematic. Then things get out of hand pretty quickly. If it's a more selective target somewhere else, maybe not. But I think, and these are individuals that understand not just the seriousness of it, but how to play this game. And they know that they will, not unlike Hamas, they'll get a massive response from Israel if they are disproportionately responsive to what happened yesterday. That said, my belief is in what Israel has to do is they have to knock out the leadership of Hamas. I haven't seen much in the public public at all about how effective Israel has been at eliminating Hamas leadership. There have been some individuals killed, but I haven't really seen that we've done that much Israel's done that much with respect to the elimination of leadership. That's got to happen.
Do you think Israel would be very forthcoming if, in fact, more had been done than we have heard about so far? Or they're not keeping secrets, are they?
Well, it's hard to right now. I mean, one of the real challenges in these wars, it's hard to keep any secrets. I mean, because everything is on film, and I mean, it's fed to the world almost as it happens. So taking that in, and again, I'm not in the inside, so I don't have the intelligence, but taking that, the way things are rolled out right now, taking that into account, it's hard for me to believe that we haven't seen some more about the impact on Hamas leadership. My own belief is that, you know, time's not on the Israeli side. I think they're going to take the side. I think they're going to take the time. And the devastation that Gaza has sustained has just been incredible. And that they're going to have to do a much better job finding the enemy and killing them and not killing civilians. And I say we've seen what's happened. It's an enormously challenging situation to do that in. And then you sort of back that up with the response from the beginning with the devastation and the horrific, horrendous attacks, you know, that they underwent and the response that I knew they would generate to deal with this threat.
They've said that they are going to withdraw significant numbers of troops from Gaza fairly soon. How important is that?
Well, I think the way I took that, Warren, was I think it will obviously bring down the devastation, if you will, somewhat. But the other is, and this is just what I've been through in the last couple of decades, these wars don't last weeks or months. They seem to last years. If you listen to Netanyahu right now, he's saying this is a long war. So they're going to have to figure out how to balance who they send in and who they bring out to take a rest before they go back in again. And that gets exacerbated dramatically if they open up another front. If they have to go north and fight in Lebanon, you know, that puts an additional significant strain, you know, on the Israeli military. So I think my overall take on that, it was more about balance and giving some of those who fought, you know, since October 7th or shortly thereafter, a reprieve or a break before they get sent back in.
Secretary General of the United Nations has made some very, very serious statements about what's going on in Gaza. And the staff of the UN has been attacked. Many people have been killed. The United States has taken a singular position by opposing first any kind of amnesty and then failing to vote on or withdrawing, yeah, excuse me, from another vote. You know the background better than I. But
right.
How much longer can Israel continue this? with that kind of international opposition?
Well, I I've dealt with Israel a lot. Israel historically has been challenged to have a lot of friends on the international stage. And clearly, we have been the one that has stood up for them. If you go back to UN vote after UN vote after UN vote, that's an indication that this is exactly where the UN would go with respect to support of Israel over time. A very close friend of mine who was, you know, senior officer, you know, in the IDF in my time, it basically, when we talked about this, he said that we just don't have a lot of friends. And so I think that will continue. It's been very clear that President Biden, one, has been enormously strong in terms of support and certainly the public support. And then secondly, behind the scenes, he is urging Israel, you know, constantly to generate a campaign or change the campaign to be more precise and to certainly do everything possible to not kill women and children, innocent civilians. That's a really difficult challenge when you look at how dense packed Gaza is. But I think Israel's got to do that. And the other thing is, the more they do that, the more time it's going to take. If I were going to use an example of my experience with Al-Qaeda, I mean, Al-Qaeda really went down hard when we started to take out their leaders on a regular basis. And part of this is also worrisome from the standpoint of fighting Hamas, because the more we kill, the more we generate. The young ones, the families that are going through this, they're never going to forget this. And how that's going to create an enemy, you know, for decades as well. That's why time is so important. And yet time is what Israel needs. And it's just, so it's an enormously complex problem with variables that are not supportive in terms of solving themselves. And that's where the leaders have to come in.
Notoriously, there has not been a lot of discussion or a lot of agreement, certainly, about what might happen after the war is over. And Prime Minister Netanyahu has been very unclear about that. He's, of course, openly said he doesn't want to see a two-state solution, the thing that you mentioned is the only way out of all of this. To what extent does his situation make it more difficult for Israel? To what extent is his interest in maintaining the war, continuing the war, given what's happening to him at home and the fact that he's under indictment and in a very shaky situation politically?
I think that's a huge part of it, Warren, that the fact that he's under indictment, criminal indictment, if you will, and has been for some time. He's clearly moved his politics to the far right to accommodate the right wing of his party or those parties, all of which do not want to have anything to do with a two-state solution. This is me guessing. I don't think his future, the future for him in that country, bodes that well. But I think he will do all he can to stay in office as long as he can. And again, that's another one of these variables that just pulls hard against a reasonable solution, you know, in the near term. You saw the Supreme Court vote yesterday, I think it was, or 2 days ago, which came out against where not Netanyahu was headed with respect to the Supreme Court and justice there. That was a good thing, I think. But I do think he will fight to stay in as long as he can, and then try to win the war, if you will. And use that as his saving grace.
Supreme Court decision might have been a good thing, but it was 8-7.
Yeah.
And that has raised questions as to whether it will be sustained.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think there's any question about that. But it was better than the other way around, at least at this point.
Let's talk a little bit about what's happening in Ukraine. And I was stunned and amazed today when there was a prisoner exchange between Ukraine and Russia, some 500 prisoners swapped at a time when Russia has been attacking Ukraine brutally with missiles. And, you know, it appeared that they're at a stalemate and that this was going to go on forever.
I think it is. I think they are at a stalemate, Warren, and I think it is going to go on for a long time. And I think Ukraine, which had the upper hand for quite some time, certainly, let's say, over the first year, 18 months, I think now it's much more balanced. Putin has come through this in a way where, one, he's virtually destroyed Ukraine. Two, he's got his defense industry up and running, so he can provide munitions for a long, long time into the future. Three, his economy is doing much better than anybody predicted it would. So I think he's settled in. And I think what you'll see from the Russians is this, these continuous rocket and artillery attacks to destroy infrastructure. And plus, he's got a massive number of troops that he can bring to the fight whenever he wants to. And even for those that he loses, he just keeps replacing them. So I think he's in a much better position than he was a year ago. And a lot of it has to do with the lack of success in that counteroffensive. You can listen to President Zelensky talk about needing weapons, et cetera, what we're going through here to make sure we get them to both Ukraine and Israel. So it's a much more balanced situation right now. I've never thought, even from the beginning, certainly for Zelensky in the first year or so, you know, I didn't want to discount anything he was saying because he was so inspirational and so focused. But honestly, I just never thought they're going to get Crimea back. And I have felt for some time, someone's got to reach in and get Zelensky to say to Zelensky, that's enough. And you can see now in our country and even in Europe that the political support is starting to wane. And when that happens, it just puts Putin in a stronger and stronger position. I don't know that on the battlefield, we can threaten Putin to get him to the table. I think we need to figure out, is there a way to threaten him, period? I mean, literally, I don't mean physically, but threaten his future in terms of, continuing to be president in Russia to get his attention so that he might make a deal. I just, there's so few things that would really get his attention to say, maybe I should make a deal. And right now, those things are not in play.
What would those three few things be?
Well, I think, obviously those I think that actually could move him are the oligarchs. And are there a way, to basically say it's time to move? What we had with Prigozhin was, another example. I mean, Putin is, and this is true with Putin, it's true in the Middle East, is these individuals are unbelievably good survivors, and they have figured out who their enemies are, and they're either in jail or they've killed them or they're out of the country. And I think supporting something like that, which could threaten him, I don't know if we could succeed, but could threaten him, and he would say, okay, now I'll sit down and make a deal. I don't think the Ukraine getting into the EU right away is enough, although I think that would be important. I think longer term, having Ukraine in the in NATO is also, very threatening. Not that I would trade that away, but I think those are the kinds of things that we have to figure out with Putin, because from a battlefield standpoint, he's settled in and he's almost even the score.
You mentioned that there's been a delay, I guess is the best way to put it, in America, if it's a delay, or certainly a momentary pause. In American support for both of these efforts, and there's a bill that would supply arms to both Ukraine and Israel, which the Republicans have put off until next year at a time when they're going to be trying to keep the government going. How much uncertainty does that create, and how much uncertainty does that mean that is advantageous to Putin, to Hamas, to everybody else who's on the other side of this?
Well, I think it creates more uncertainty in Ukraine right now. My belief is that somehow we'll figure out a way to get the support to Israel. But I do think it creates more uncertainty in Ukraine, and that makes it much more difficult for Zelensky to lead his troops. I mean, if you some of the press I've read about them running out of bullets, the number of rounds they use every day is dramatically down. Just to conserve rounds, et cetera. So it's hugely disconcerting and actually destabilizing. And it also becomes fuel and energy for Putin when he sees that. So, getting that, and I believe in us, and I believe that we should not isolate ourselves. I think if we do that, That's really problematic for the long term. So I think these bills, all three aspects of it, Israel, Taiwan, and Ukraine, are really, really critical. And I don't have honestly, at this point, I think how whatever the trade space is to make that happen, I think it would really be smart for the Biden administration to make the trades.
You hear Republicans saying that, some on the far right anyway, that, or I don't know, maybe they're in the middle. I'm never quite sure where they stand in the Republican scheme of things, that Ukraine is not our war, that we don't have to get involved in it, that we don't need to. How do you respond to that?
I think in the last couple of years, almost every European I've talked to, it's an existential threat to Europe. And I actually believe that Ukraine wouldn't be the end. It would be very, very short order. Putin would be in Moldova. I think my friends historically in the Baltics, in Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, were frightened on their best day that the Russians would be coming over the horizon. So I think individuals like this, we have to figure out how to stop them and stop them in their tracks, because I just think he'll continue. And he'll continue to threaten Europe. I mean, this is, and I'm not as good a historian as I'd like to be, and a lot of Americans aren't, but this is war on the continent, which has been there for, you know, thousands of years. And it is really threatening, and it threatens all of them, which is why they've come together. We are in support of them dramatically. And I think it has to be contained as opposed to just continue to expand. And does it get to sort of the question of this particular session is, you know, do we get to a point where it really is a world war?
So either one of these is has the potential of becoming a world war. Is that right? Is it, but people keep saying that.
No, I actually believe the biggest threat is Taiwan. I really believe that going to war with China over Taiwan is the most significant threat, the biggest danger. And we need to, my view is we need to act accordingly with respect to that. But it is one of these things, Warren, because it's almost, you can't have a war out there without it being global, particularly with respect to the impact on the economy and the weapons that we have now and China is developing. And yet you have that, you have Europe, you have the Middle East. I mean, there's not much left. And they are, in a way, in a global world right now, they become connected. And if we as Americans don't stand up for those kinds of democracies, if you will, then people are going to look at us and say, well, you know, who are we? What do we stand for? What are the alliances and partnerships that really make a difference? And I think in this world, we have to have those partners and those allies to move forward in a way that supports the values that we like, the values that we believe in, the kind of democracy that we believe in, with all of which I think is threatened, not just externally, but also internally right now.
Taiwan, of course, doesn't get a whole lot of attention because there's nothing going on there at the very moment. But there is money in that appropriation, as I understand it, to go to Taiwan.
Correct.
And how important is it?
It's critical. Taiwan forever has been, I would say, a very low priority for our government in terms of supporting, particularly on the military side. Yeah. When I was the chairman, the whole time I was the chairman, back in 2007 to 2011, I didn't spend any time on Taiwan. I assure you that my reliefs, the current chairman, General Brown, as well as before him, spent a lot of time on Taiwan and making sure we comply with the Taiwan Relations Act, get them the weapons that they need to defend themselves. Yet, most importantly, get to a point where we don't get into a conflict with China over Taiwan at a time where the Taiwanese people, 24 million of them, are becoming more and more democratic, more and more independent. And then we have a leader in China who is becoming more and more assertive and more and more demonstrative in terms of what he says he's going to do to reunite, to basically unify China with Taiwan. So it's real in that regard, it's really dangerous. When President Xi and President Biden met in November, you know, my dream would have been to have those two individuals stand shoulder to shoulder on a world stage and say, we are not going to war over Taiwan and we'll figure it out. And we'd be supportive. I mean, I know from the U.S. standpoint, we would be supportive of that. It's hard to know what Xi Jinping's going to do. And he's also clearly learning lessons from what's going on in Europe with Ukraine and his, you know, his new best friend, Putin, and obviously now paying a lot of attention to the Middle East. So in one sense, yes, they're three different areas, but in so many ways, they're joined.
Well, is the threat then that China might actually invade Taiwan and try to take it over militarily?
That's one of them. That would be the most radical, if you will. I mean, there are discussions about blockading Taiwan. It's an island. Where does it get its energy? Where does it get its food? Where does it get its water? Those kinds of things, as some kind of interim way. There are talks about China taking a couple of the other islands that are nearby Taiwan. That's part of the Taiwan complex. And then again, after that, you know, it's would they conduct an amphibious operation, if you will, to try and take over. And it's a very complex, it's not an easy operation. It's the most complex military operation known to man to do that, to come across that 150 miles or so to do that. And we have focused on it greatly in the last 6 or 7 years. And so we're in a lot better shape to support them should the president decide to do that than we were a few years ago. And the Taiwanese military is in better shape. But the best outcome, quite frankly, is to make sure that doesn't happen. And we have the semiconductor center of the world there in TSMC, the manufacturer. We all talk about our dependence on the semiconductor industry. And if a war occurred there and we lost TSMC, we'd really find out how dependent we are, because so much of what we do, it depends on that technology, and it would shut down.
Don't we do so much business with China that it would be suicide to get into a confrontation with them economically?
Certainly the economy. Yeah, that would certainly be part of it. We do that, although, you know, in the last several years, there's a whole lot less money, yeah. U.S. money going into China. It's now they're looking for it's being put and invested in other places, Vietnam, Singapore, places like Malaysia, Indonesia, places like that, to try to diversify. So it's not as robust as it used to be. And the message that when I talk to the business community that I get from them is they really are concerned about exactly what you're talking about and will their investments be sustained over time. That said, the investment is still very, very significant, which is another reason to not do it, which gets back to my dream of having Biden and Xi saying, we're just not going to do this. And as you know, or as we all know, that didn't happen at the meeting that they had.
Interesting that a military officer has to know as much as you do about the economy. I mean, that's really a lot of what the military action is about.
Yeah, well, it's something I believed in for a long time. Where I have been, where economies are doing well, the military doesn't have a lot of work, and the other way around. So I've always been a believer. I use this metric that I learned many years ago. I never met a family in how many countries I was in around the world that didn't want to raise their kids to a higher standard of living than they had. And where that's working, it's usually reasonably peaceful. And where it's not, it becomes very, very dangerous.
We've got a lot of questions on chat that people in the audience have submitted, and I can't answer them really in a sequence that makes sense thematically. So I'll just pick them up as I read them. Here's Victor, who says, was the massive bombing in Gaza a mistake? Hamas is underground. My example is Iwo Jima. Massive aerial and naval bombardment didn't work. Japanese had to be dug out cave by cave. 7,000 Marines died in the process.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I don't know how you would dig them out without going in with the heavy artillery first. We've seen certainly and I think been surprised at the depth and the sophistication of the tunnels that are there in Gaza. So I honestly, when I saw us using 2,000 pound, the Israelis using 2,000 pound bombs, it's really difficult to be precise with a 2,000 pound weapon and not kill an awful lot of civilians or you know, outside the target. And I don't want to, honestly, I don't want to second guess the Israelis and the military, because they don't have the intelligence, quite frankly. And as I said before, I don't know how many of Hamas have been killed. Someone pointed out early in a week or two after October 7th, that something along the lines is, you know, when we went into Manila towards the end of World War II, there were 100,000 civilians that got killed when we went in. The difference, obviously, is you didn't have the visibility of it, the instantaneous view that was going on. Part of this is war, and war is hell for a reason. And this is, I don't want to say it's, this is not, I think it's too much. I think they need to be more careful. That said, they are not going to let this happen again. And I know that part of the world well enough to understand that when something like that happens to their family, happens to their women, their kids, and what happened to them, that somebody said to me, you know, they've got blood in their nostrils and they are not going to ever let it happen again. And there's a revenge piece of this to respond, and there's a strategic piece of this to make sure that it never happens again.
But the response, the 2,000 pound bombs, looks disproportionate to people who haven't experienced it the way the Israelis have.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that, Warren. Those are big weapons, and I don't know how you get those in a place as dense as Gaza without killing a lot of innocent people.
Lauren asks, I'll let Lauren's estimate of things stand. With most Palestinians, 80%, and most Israelis, maybe almost as high, opposing the two-state solution, how do you suggest we get both sides to get that solution? It seems unrealistic.
Like all these things, it wasn't that unrealistic a few years ago. And I think all these things are going to take good leaders to be able to lead us to a solution like that. There may be another solution. I'm just not aware of what it is at this particular point in time. It's going to take really talented, charismatic, dedicated, competent leaders to get us to that point. And if someone comes up with a better idea to essentially create a peace in the Middle East that is sustained, I'm certainly open to listen to it.
A question from Stuart about the other issue that we've talked about. Isn't degrading Russia's military by continuing support of Ukraine one of the most cost-effective military investments we can possibly make?
Yeah, I to some extent, I think that's true. But, Russia's military has been enormously they haven't been very good from the beginning here. I've been stunned, quite frankly. That said, my own experience with them when they went into Georgia, eventually they just mass. You know, they bring mass in terms of weapons, they bring mass in terms of people, and they just keep throwing people at it. A lot of their equipment is really outdated and it's old, and they just do the best they can with it, try to refurbish it and then put it back in. So I've been singularly unimpressed with their military from my point of view. That said, they're not going away. And what I would call the sort of the Stalingrad model, you know, that's something that comes throughout history. And I think we saw it in the last few days with the rockets that were going into those cities. And I think we're going to see more and more of that. And yes, is it better to have Ukraine be fighting that than us at this particular point in time? Absolutely. One of the most devastating weapons in the world has not been introduced in the fight over there, and that's nuclear weapons. And if Russia really gets put on their back foot, you know, I've never put it past Putin that he wouldn't pull that card out and play with a new, you know, and get a nuclear weapon out and use it. And then we're a whole lot closer to that world war we talked about.
Is there any such thing as preparation for a nuclear war?
Yeah, there are. I mean, in terms of understanding how to deal with the weapons, and we have, sadly, through the Cold War, we have a rich history of how to do that. And we may have lost some of that history, but I'm sure you know, in recent times, because of the potential of the threat, that our forces are very focused on that and would know, one, you know, how to respond, how to respond if attacked, and also, you know, sadly, if we needed to counter, how to do that as well.
Of course, we're upgrading all the time, too, and making things conceivably worse, just my opinion. Here's an interesting question that goes to you, your experience as an admiral. Why is the U.S. moving the Gerald Ford Aircraft Carrier Task Force out of the Middle East?
I don't know the answer because I'm not at the table. That said, we are in a situation where you have to rotate those. I would assume that there will be somebody else, some other carrier group that would basically come in behind them and relieve them in the not too distant future. We only have a total of 11 aircraft carriers. Obviously we've got to use them judiciously. I think they've had a big presence impact, a big deterrence impact. The two of them over there right now, it wouldn't surprise me, and I just don't know, it wouldn't surprise me to see an additional one relieve Ford, maybe not face-to-face, but in the not-too-distant future.
Here's a question from Lisa. You mentioned Europe before in regard to Ukraine. Would Europe be willing to commit additional support to Ukraine if the U.S. Congress doesn't? They're the ones whose existence is threatened the most.
I just think we're the lead for this. And in many ways, Europe is going to follow our lead. Maybe not, certainly in the near term, they may provide support. But without our support in the long term, I think Europe doing it by itself just probably isn't going to happen. Even as you start to see the political will inside Europe wane to some degree. I had hopes that we would get through this winter, two winters, and then that we'd get to the peace table, if you will, and there would be some resolution. Obviously, that's not going to happen. And I think, in addition, because of our election cycle, I think Putin's going to wait to see who wins our election to figure out what he's going to do next.
How do you get to the peace table if Zelensky continues to say he wants to take the Crimean Peninsula back?
I think my own view is Biden has to tell him that's not going to happen. Get to the table. And otherwise, I mean, his principal supporter, yeah, I think we've got a lot of leverage with respect to that, to getting him to do what we want him to do in that regard.
Mike and Phil want to know, has the administration been late and lacking in giving Ukraine the needed components for air support? How important would air capacity have been in prosecuting the war?
I'm not sure that it would have made a whole lot of difference in terms of this counteroffensive, which took place or didn't take place, which was sort of the big issue for this spring. I think it's important. I'd like to have seen it. I would like to have gotten it there sooner. The Ukrainians have been asking for it almost since the beginning, but I'm not sure it would have been dispositive in changing the outcome at this particular point in time. What needed to happen in this counteroffensive was to have Ukraine drive through almost, to the border of their country and to the Black Sea and take control of some of those lands. And they did not find themselves in a position to be comfortable enough in what we call combined arms. So their artillery, their infantry, their aviation, all moving in concert together, you know, in a campaign to be able to do that and break the Russians down. And the Russians put up formidable defenses, as we know, in the trenches, you know, with the mines that they had out there. And that became a real obstacle as well.
Phil wants to know this. He says, Biden has been continuously late on major weapons for Ukraine, including longer range missiles. You've answered some of these questions. Would providing longer range missiles, including ones that could hit Russia, help to weaken Putin?
I think we have done that. The ATACMS was the latest one to go in, and that was the one that the administration was very cautious on because of the range that it has. I mean, my overall view is I think the administration has handled this pretty well. I think Biden clearly doesn't want to get into a world war. He does not want this thing to break into a war with Russia. In that regard, he's been pretty cautious with respect to that. So, I mean, it's a very, very fine line you walk when you commit forces or don't commit forces to make sure it doesn't get out of control. And he doesn't want to commit U.S. forces, certainly at this point in time, to be fighting the Russians in Ukraine.
Amy wants to know, how stretched are U.S. arms supply chains? And if they are too stretched, how fast can that be fixed?
I think they are stretched, and I think it's a matter of years to really fix them, you know, like we need to fix them. It's been very clear, it's been reported widely that we're short of 155 artillery shells, for example, and that we've gotten, you know, South Korea has given us a bunch of them, and then we've given Ukraine a bunch of ours, kind of thing. It's almost from an offset standpoint. And we have to be careful about that. We can't just run our stores out completely as well. But I think we didn't anticipate that we would be in a situation to see the volume of these weapons that are being used. That said, every war, it almost seems that way, that we're not ready in that regard. We use a lot more munitions than we anticipate. And certainly that's the case now, and that is a huge lesson for the future.
Robert wants to know, does the Admiral believe that the hostages are still alive, and how does the IDF identify Hamas from a Palestinian citizen?
Well, I think, I'd leave that to the IDF. They're pretty good at that. They've been doing that a long time in terms of identification. It may not be perfect, but they're very good at it. And I do believe the hostages are still alive. I think that card how Hamas plays that card is hugely critical to how this goes in the future. And I mean, one of my reactions to the killing yesterday of the Hamas number two political guy up in Lebanon was whether or not Hamas would react with respect to the hostages in a pretty negative and devastating way. I just don't know. And I don't have a good handle on the kind of intelligence that we have with respect to the location of them. I actually was a bit surprised to find out early in the hostage crisis that there are a bunch of groups, small groups that don't have a particularly strong relationship with Hamas who have hostages as well, who've taken hostages. And at least as it's been reported, really had no way of getting in touch with those groups as part of the hostage, you know, the groups that have hostages as well. So again, it's another one of those really, really complex, it's part of that very complex puzzle. And at the same time, if Hamas gives up its leverage, it just sort of, from my standpoint, it opens them up to a much wider and difficult conflict, you know, with the IDF. So how and when they're going to give them up, I'm not really sure.
I'm told that several people have asked this question. There are variations on it. You've said something about it, but they want you to elaborate. Do you think that the U.S. is making a mistake by not striking back at Iran and their surrogates when they attack the shipping lanes in the Red Sea? I think we've covered that, but people want to know more.
Well, I think they did. They hit the Houthis yesterday or a couple of days ago. So and I think that's an indication. That's an indication that we've now gotten to a point where we're going to do that. How strong it should be. And again, I think the bigger strategic question, and it's not to be done right now, is how to put pressure on Iran so that they get them to back off. I think that's really key. And is there a way to punish Iran and leverage the economy, leverage sanctions, leverage the international community in a way that would get Iran to have the Houthis back off? And quite frankly, to have Hezbollah stay out of it and to have Syria be quiet.
Jerry wants to know, if NATO quickly embraces Ukraine and supports them with troops as well as weapons, do you think Russia will come to the table?
Well, NATO is, I mean, by and large, NATO is supporting them, and Russia hasn't come to the table. I think I'm one that believes that we ought to get Ukraine into the EU as quickly as possible. Easy for me to say, I'm not a member of the EU. That said, one of the questions I asked very early in the Ukrainian conflict was, what's going to happen to 40 million Ukrainians? What's going to happen to 140 million Russians? we're going to have to the world, I think, is going to have to help rebuild Ukraine, rebuild their industries. And I think the economic, back to your question earlier, I think the economic piece here is really critical. Can we move to help Ukraine get back to a functioning economy very, very rapidly? And then I think the longer term, this is me, the longer term question is whether they should get into NATO or not. I don't think we should certainly discount or trade off support for them getting into NATO in a discussion with Putin.
You, of course, mentioned China and the threat that China poses. Lee Barkin wants to know, are you concerned about China's greater shipbuilding capacity versus the United States?
I am in general. Yes, just because of the numbers. And that said, I do think China's military is evolving, and they have been a land force for a long time. They've had a reasonable sized Navy just in recent years. It takes a lot of time and a lot of effort and a lot of training to be able to create what we call in our Navy, a blue water Navy that can go around the world. They don't have that kind of equivalency right now, even though they do have numbers. And certainly they can work hard with those numbers to try to protect themselves close to their home waters. I think globally they would be very challenged in that regard. So yes, I'm concerned about it. I don't consider it to be serious enough to certainly deter us from what we're doing, nor do I think they would be that much of a threat per se to our Navy. That said, the weapons we have these days are much more sophisticated, and they need less human interaction, and you know, because of the technology. So it doesn't mean they can't hurt us, because they certainly can.
Can you imagine a military confrontation between the United States and China? Is that in the cards, or would it be something less direct?
No, I think Taiwan is the flashpoint. And in that regard, yes, it would be a military confrontation between the two of us. And then the question is, could you contain it? And I mean, I'm listening to Guns of August right now. And I just shake my head at the idiotic leaders from country after country after country that allowed themselves to get into war where they could have headed it off. And I worry when you have these things happen, it starts in how do you stop it? Before it just breaks out into a conflagration that is, you know, the worst we've ever had. So that's where the leadership and the diplomacy and the economics and the military, I mean, we've got to push ahead in a way to make sure we don't break out in a world war. Despite what Xi Jinping says, which says he's not going to war, I just don't believe it. We don't know him very well. He's an unbelievably powerful guy. Whose economy isn't doing very well right now. And I just don't know. I don't know what he's going to do. When people ask me, are we going to go to war over Taiwan? I think the only guy on the planet that knows that is Xi Jinping, and I'm not even sure he knows it.
Okay, we started out with the idea of a path for peace. There are several people now who are asking, what about that path for peace? And how would you describe it? Where would you look to see it begin?
Well, I think it's got to happen. It almost has to happen in those three centers right now. And even as Hamas, the Israel-Hamas war broke out very quickly, there were those that were asking questions, how does this end? Where are we going here? Which is really kidding. You need a strategy to get to a resolution, to get to the table, to get to a ceasefire, to get to a frozen conflict, something like that, and then move from there. So we've got to get to, a ceasefire in Europe or a resolution in Europe, and we've got to get to a resolution in the Middle East per se. And I think leaders around the world have to come together to make sure that we are headed in that direction, and that's going to take some compromise. From a lot of people's point of view. And I also think we need to deal with it from a position of strength, from our military being exceptionally strong, so that we are in a deterrent mode and never have to use the military that we're building. And then that becomes an example. That becomes a place that Xi Jinping can look at and say, look, I don't want to go to war. We're going to have to figure out how to do this peacefully. That, to me, with the chess pieces that are on the board right now, to me, that's a path, but that's a really, really tough problem to solve, as you've seen.
The late David Lehrer, much beloved of all of us, used to ask at the end of the program, or ask us to ask at the end of the program, is there anything you can say that would be optimistic, that would lighten the conversation a bit?
It's tough to find it right now. Warren, honestly, I understand that. I had a conversation yesterday with a Russian historian, American, who's a Russian historian, said, well, you know, you should never forget, you know, the 70s, if you will, and, you know, the 68, the 70s, et cetera. We were in a pretty tough spot back then with the presidency. We were in a tough spot with the war. And it was his view that it was tougher then than it is now. And we got through that. And I never want to underestimate the power, the resources, the substance, and the values of our country to get through these kinds of crises. But it is, and I do have faith that we will figure out a way to do that. I just hope the path isn't as devastating as what we see in Gaza right now in many places in the world. I think it can be done, but leaders have to engage in ways that I haven't seen a lot of them out there do that right now.
I haven't asked you any political questions. You're a military guy. I don't think you want to answer any. So
that's correct.
People have have raised them. I'm sure you know what they must be, but I'm not going to put them to you. I'll let you off without that. It's been great to have you with us, Mike Mullen. And obviously, you said at the beginning that wars last years. That may be the lesson that we all have to take from this. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Warren.